Thank you for being my guest today, Noodle. Anything else you want to say to anybody? You want to step on the computer. That's what you want to say to everybody. Okay, well, thank you for coming on, and I hope to have you back real soon. Say goodbye. Good job.
My name is Andy Dorado. This is Furthermore. We take the month's bestseller from the New York City bookstore where I work, we read the first 50 pages, and we decide, would we delve in or would we shelve it? Today on Furthermore, we celebrate all things November by reading fellow Scorpio Min Jin Lee's book, Pachinko, a National Book Award nominated book from 2017 that also happened to be April's bestseller at the bookstore. Listen, when I was conceiving of this podcast, Pachinko had sold the most copies in April. And at the time, my wife, Risa Rest, said to me, hey, if you need to record a practice episode, why don't we do Pachinko? Much to her delight and to mine, because it was something we really wanted to read. Listen, everyone, that practice episode will never see the light of day, but that's fine because we have this episode and it's better, and who better to record with me than my wife, Risa Rest. Risa and I are going to take a look at Noodle, our dog, because he's a very good boy and he deserves to be looked at. But we'll also discuss Pachinko by Min Jin Lee. We'll discuss what made Risa want to read it in the first place, who at the hospital where she works may still have her copy. We'll discuss Min Jin Lee's smart, economical writing. Risa calls me out on not always explaining things very well. Sorry, I know I don't do that, but don't worry, Risa's got your back. Vent with her. Happy birthday to all the fellow November birthdays out there. I've talked too much. Let's discuss Pachinko. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Furthermore. My name is Andy, and today I am joined by a very, 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 very special guest. I am joined by my wife, Risa. Risa, what is your last name?
Ress.
Very easy to say. Risa, welcome to Furthermore.
Thank you.
I don't have any special fancy music picked out for you this time, unlike the recap episode.
Oh, I'm kind of disappointed.
I want special music. I can try to edit something in if you want me to.
No, I mean, don't I deserve that?
Yes, you do. That was Risa's stipulation. She had read through Where the Crawdads Sing for the recap episode. If you haven't listened to that and you've listened to some of our earlier episodes, definitely check that out. But Risa had read Where the Crawdads Sing, and she said, you know, I'd like to come on and talk about it, but I will only come on if you give me special music. And so I did.
I need a special, like, segment,
yeah.
You know?
Were you happy with the special music I gave you?
I think so. Yeah. But, you know, I think that we need a special, what you want to call it, like a title-y thing.
Oh, right. We'll figure that out later. But anyway, welcome to this episode of Furthermore, where we are talking about Pachinko by Min Jin Lee. Risa, why don't you tell the Furthermore listeners a little bit about yourself?
My name is Risa. My favorite colors are yellow and orange. I also like polka dots. And I'm a music therapist, and I have a dog named Noodle.
Noodle is actually here with us right now. We're recording in our room in our apartment, and Noodle is on the bed. So
as he wags his tail.
Yes, if you hear any thumping, it's probably Noodle wagging his tail. So Risa and I are doing a very special episode today of Pachinko. When Risa and I were throwing around ideas for the podcast, we finally, you know, as we were talking, kind of had this idea for what Furthermore has now become. And as we were talking about it, Risa said, great, this is a good idea. Why don't we do a practice episode on Pachinko? And neither of us had read it at that point in time. And so we actually did that practice episode. How do you feel that old practice episode went?
I mean, it was fine, but it was a practice episode. You know, practice episodes are meant, or practice is meant to be just that, practice.
So here we are doing the real thing.
Which is weird.
Talk about it again. But so we had done a little bit of an episode, and we're back to recording this now. Now, Pachinko actually was the bestseller at the store back in April. So this is 1 month right before our very first episode, Where the Crawdads Sing. I thought that was a great thing. But, you know, before we get into talking a little bit more about that, I'm going to subject Risa to the usual Furthermore questions.
I am no different than any other guest.
You are not. Are you ready for these questions?
I am totally ready.
The first question is, do you have a favorite book?
I think that I probably do, but I don't want to say the book that I think that your podcast and you think that I'm going to say, so I'm not going to say it.
It's Where'd You Go, Bernadette.
It's the best book I've read in the past couple years, no. Yeah. But it can't be my favorite book of all time.
No.
that's probably not the case.
Why not?
Because I don't think it is.
Oh, got it. Well, what is it? I have talked about Where'd You Go, Bernadette with multiple guests who Risa has given that book to read. So what is it about Where'd You Go, Bernadette that you like?
I love that it's funny, but not too funny. I love that it's heartfelt, but not too heartfelt. I love the format of it. Like, I love the emails and...
It's told in a very, like, linear story, but it's told through emails,
different
sometimes
formats.
Letters.
Like, yeah. It's just, like, each chapter is different. You don't know what you're really going to get.
Right.
Which is really fun. Yeah. I hadn't read anything like that up until that point.
Yeah.
But that's definitely probably my favorite book of the last probably 6 years or so.
Yeah. Did you have a favorite book as a kid?
Oh, yes. Phantom Tollbooth.
Oh, yeah. Which actually, Risa, when I first met her, she said, you really have to read Phantom Tollbooth.
And I didn't want to read it.
I loved it in the end.
But you didn't.
I didn't want to read it?
I don't think so.
Oh. That must be as Jess alluded to on our episode about Pet, I'm very bad at taking people's recommendations. Although I did take quite a few recommendations from you when we first started dating.
Well, yeah, that's how dating works.
Yeah. I read Still Life with Woodpecker by Tom Robbins and
yeah.
fell in love with Tom Robbins. So that's great. Risa, do you have a genre that you usually read?
As I said on the podcast the last time I was here in my special segment, I am such a sucker for hype. Like, if other people are reading it, I want to read it.
Yeah.
It usually doesn't take much. Like, if someone recommends it to me, I'll probably read it.
Yeah.
So...
But you don't have a specific, like, style or genre of book that you gravitate
towards?
No,
I'm pretty much... I'll read anything once. So, I'm not the biggest, like, nonfiction person, but that doesn't mean that I won't
mm-hmm.
read nonfiction. I definitely have. I really like Malcolm Gladwell.
Yeah.
I've also been known to enjoy Elizabeth... What's her face?
Elizabeth Gilbert?
Yeah.
Eat, Pray, Love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, or...
You read. I feel like you were reading David Sedaris long ago,
yeah.
too.
I haven't read a ton of his stuff, but I definitely have read a bunch of his stuff.
Yeah. Do you have a genre that you don't like? Because Risa really is, you really are, like, if somebody says to you, this is a really good book, you should read it, you really will pick it up. But do you have anything that you're like, I just don't love that kind of book, I'm not going to read that one?
I don't know how to answer this properly, because it kind of goes hand in hand with my movie or TV or watching preferences.
Yeah.
I'm really not very good with, like, horror thriller genre. That's not to say that I haven't read every single thriller book that has been out with the word woman or girl in the title. But it's usually not my favorite. Again, I will definitely read it, but they're not my favorite because I need to shut them sometimes.
Yeah. Did you read Girl with a Dragon Tattoo long
ago? I did.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And how was that as a thriller for you? Did you feel like...
Well, that book is weird because the first... Who told me to read it? I don't remember who it was. But they were like, the first 50 pages are bad.
Mm.
And I remember they were Ooh. Bad. But I did get it through it. And then it was good after that.
But it wasn't too much violence and... Like, was that one that you had to put down sometimes?
There's a decent amount of violence in the book and I did have to shut it.
Yeah.
I've been known to do that on the subway. One time, though, I was reading a book where there was a very violent scene, and then I got off the subway train, and then I proceeded to faint.
That was scary to hear about later.
It was fine. I got home. It was great. I had a guitar on my back.
She's okay now.
Aided my fall.
Yes, you are okay now.
I'm fine.
That was years ago now.
But... I'm fine. But yes, it's not my favorite thing. But again, I'll pick up another one. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Soon after. So.
How long does it usually take you to read a book?
So I've been a lifelong lover of reading. I can read pretty darn fast.
Yeah.
But I go through phases. So sometimes it's like I am not in a phase where I can read anything right now. And if that's the case, then a book will take me much longer. But if I'm in a good phase of, I can sit down and read stuff, it might take me just a couple days.
Yeah. I feel like I consistently am reading things and consistently I'll finish a book in like a week or two because I usually just, you know, will read it on the train or I don't carve out a ton of time to read things a lot, but, you know, I'm fairly consistent with it. Whereas Risa will read either three books in the time it takes me or one book in the time it takes me to read like 3 months worth of books, you will still be reading it. So it was very funny to me how you sort of fluctuate between like, I have to finish this and I'm just taking my time with
this. Well, I mean, it's like my brain has space to read it or it doesn't have space to read it. So like right now I'm in a phase where I don't have space in my brain. It's like when people ask me about the show, what's it called? This Is Us. Yeah. They're like, oh, Risa, you would love This Is Us. I'm like, oh, I'm sure I would, but I don't have the emotional space for that. Thank you, but no. So at the moment, I don't have the emotional space to read a book right now, but that changes pretty quickly. Yeah,
definitely. And when you read a book, how do you keep your page?
I'm notorious for saving lots of crappy pieces of paper that I don't need. Like, I mean, my husband manages a bookstore, so it's usually a bookstore receipt. That's usually it. Or a train ticket. Or
sometimes if I get something for Risa, if she's like, oh, I really wanted to read that book, and I'm like, I'll get it for you. I come home and the thing you use as a bookmark is a piece of paper that just says, Andy, because I've saved it for myself.
don't want anybody to buy it. Andy likes to do, or like receipt paper. I feel like you put a lot of things on, like notes.
Yeah. Yep.
And so then, yeah, it says Andy in capital letters. I wish I could find one.
Don't want anybody to take it. Well, even if you could find one, it's not like the people at home could see it.
That's true. But I also tend to leave them in the book.
Yes.
So it's not like I use the same thing.
But that's fun because then you come back to it later and you're like, wow, I have this train ticket from Scotland that I'm using as a bookmark.
Or, wow, why did I save this piece of paper?
Andy must have really wanted this book. It just says Andy in big letters.
Yeah.
And now, have you ever read anything else by this author?
No.
Mm-mm. She has another book out, 2007, that one came out. It's called Free Food for Millionaires. But Pachinko was the really big one for her. Now, so let's pivot a little bit here to Pachinko. Min Jin Lee was born in Korea. They moved to the United States when she was 6 or 7, and they moved to Queens. I think they moved to Elmhurst. So she grew up.
Oh, I worked in Elmhurst for a little bit.
That's right. And you had a fairly large community or population of
Tibetan children.
Tibetan kids. That's right.
They were really fun. I had so many children named Tenzin.
What were you were like coordinating a
music? I was a music and theater teacher.
Yeah.
Yep. An after school program. That area in general. Elmhurst, Queens is very ethnically diverse.
Yeah, definitely. And,
and like I think I had three or four Tenzins. So I was like, and Tenzin is a girl's name. And so Andy was like, what, Tenzin? And I was like, it's like the Caitlin of Tibet.
The Caitlin of Tibet. I mean, best borough?
Queens.
Queens is the best borough. We don't live in Queens. We used to live in Astoria. I have always thought Queens was really cool. Elmhurst is really weird because it's like everything seems to be sort of off this large, it's not even like a highway. I don't even remember. Is it the Golden Parkway or whatever that runs through there or something? I don't know. It's just this like
Queens Boulevard.
It's Queens Boulevard, right. It's just this long thoroughfare that runs and there's so much stuff just like coming off of it, little places. And there's a mall out like towards Rego Park. It's a really interesting area, but there are so many really cool areas of Queens.
There was a supermarket called Golden Sparkling Market smelled really bad, but it was great.
It smelled really bad that one time we went because I'm pretty certain a sewer pipe had blown or something like that. So
yeah, but they had great things.
Yeah, you could get some fun vegetables and stuff there. I don't remember how we got onto the subject of
I think you said Queens. That, what's her name?
Oh, she was, so apparently she learned to read and write in English in the libraries out in Queens. So shout out to New York Public Libraries. She worked as a lawyer for a few years and finally gave up being a lawyer to be a writer. She wrote, like I said, 2007, she wrote her first book and then she wrote Pachinko, which was nominated for the National Book Award in 2017. It ended up losing to Sing Unburied Sing by Jessamine Ward. But when it comes to Pachinko.
So you say things a lot like on the podcast that I just want to ask about.
Yeah.
You say like long list, short list. Was it on the long list? Was it on the short list?
When something goes on the long list, there's usually maybe like 10, and for different genres. So there would be the National Book Award in fiction, nonfiction, young adult, poetry, and translated literature. But so they'll have a long list, which is about 10 books. And then they narrow that down, and that's when it becomes shortlisted.
So the longlist is really only 10 books?
There's not a lot of new, you know, there's a lot of things that
come out. That should be called the sort of long
list. But it's like the Oscars, how sometimes there's like 20 movies nominated for Best Picture, and then some years there's like
that's never 20.
That would be a good year.
It was 10 that one year.
There were a lot one year. I don't remember what year that was. So things get cut down to the short list. And so this is they put on the cover of this book, National Book Award finalist, which is the same as being shortlisted for the National Book Award.
Gotcha.
So this year they have yet to announce the winner, but they do have the shortlist done. So this one was, I mean, that's a pretty prestigious honor for a book. And she did end up not winning that year. But when it comes to Pachinko, you had heard some hype. You say you're a sucker for hype. So what about Pachinko?
I hadn't really heard so much hype other than from you.
Right.
But it was mostly because this is a couple years ago, but I was really into the series is technically called the Neapolitan novels.
Yes.
But
it's by Elena Ferrante.
Correct. Yeah. But she they're called My Brilliant Friend is the first one. And I can never remember what the rest of them are called because I just call them, the second book in the My Brilliant Friend. But that's not the name of the book. I was really, really into them because they kind of, it's a coming of age story among four books. But I had come off that and Andy was like, there's a Korean story that's a coming of age book. And you also kind of described it as multi-generational. Mm-hmm. And years ago at this point I was really into The Pillars of the Earth, by Ken Follett.
Yeah,
which Follett,
I think. I don't think he's French.
I don't know. I think that was one of those books that if you ever go to a used book sale, there's always like 20 copies of Pillars of the Earth, because I feel like it was a major book club book, and then people were like, I'm done with this. But that is very much a multi-generational story of people that are building a cathedral over centuries. And I really enjoyed that. So you were kind of, I think you presented it to me as kind of like a fusion of the two, but from a very Eastern standpoint, whereas My Brilliant Friend is clearly Italy, and Pillars of the Earth was, you know, somewhere.
I don't remember. I know it was in Europe somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, the Pachinko for me was one, I hadn't read it, but when people came to me at the store and said, you know, my friend just finished the Elena Ferrante novels and they like, I need something like that that's just going to hook me in. And Pachinko seemed like a pretty natural pivot because it was a very long family saga. I knew it was very well written. It had been up for the National Book Award. It was selling really, really well. It was on the New York Times, like 10 best selling books of the year, which again is one of those things for me running a bookstore in New York City definitely carries a lot of clout when the New York Times releases that top 10 best books of the year, people really, they'll buy from there.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, I'm thinking about before I had a husband, the manager's bookstore. I mean, the thing I would do is go to the library and there would always be a section of the library where the top 10 sellers of the New York Times would be listed somewhere. And if I needed, like, you know, help to figure out what I wanted, because I would just look there
and
pick something off that list, whatever they had there.
Yeah.
Or I was a big person for Oprah's book list.
Oh, yeah, book clubs.
Yeah.
Book clubs were huge. Now, to be fair, I do need to make the distinction that at the end of the year, the New York Times releases their top 10 best-selling books
for the
of the year. Yeah.
So
it's not their best selling. It's like their favorite, their book review favorite ones, which is different from if you just Google New York Times bestsellers.
I feel like this is different. Becoming an episode of translations of books for sellers.
Well, I bring it up because it's very funny to me. If you Google the New York Times best selling list, I don't mean this disparagingly, but I think of a lot of the books that grace that list as airport books. There are things like James Patterson.
They're ones that you're going to pick
Jody
up.
Jodi Picoult, Daniel Steele. Exactly. There are things that can come in mass market paperbacks, which are those little, like $9.99. So a little bit smaller size. A lot of mysteries are published in that. You can pick them up at the airport for cheap. They'll serve you well on a plane, and you can you know, get rid of them after that. A lot of
don't
books
don't get rid
on
of
that,
your books, people.
Well,
give
you can,
them
you
to
can
other
give
people.
Them to us. To, they can put pillars of the earth them and give them to your
but
library.
Don't give
to sell.
Them to Andy because we have too many books here.
I don't need any James Patterson or Daniel Steele books. I'm good. I just bring that up because it makes that distinction. Now, Pachinko is not something I would think of as an airport book. It's up for a lot of awards. It was very highly reviewed by a lot of things. But so before you, so I was the reason that you wanted to read this.
Yeah. I mean, for the most part, if you recommend me something, I will probably read it.
Yeah.
I can't really think of any time you've steered me too wrong.
Yeah. Well, it's funny to me because I don't think I don't remember coming home to you one night and saying, you know what book you have to read is Pachinko. I feel like you had coworkers that also were saying that same thing to you of, you know, I just finished the Elena Ferrante novels, or even you were thinking, I just finished those and I was kind of looking for something else. And I think I said to you a few times, oh, I've been recommending this book called Pachinko at the store. And then when we were talking about this podcast idea, I looked at the sales and I said, oh, Pachinko is the bestseller. And you said, I really want to read that. Why don't we talk about it on the podcast? So here we are.
Here we are.
I mean, were you excited to read it when I brought it home?
Yeah, I mean, I really, at the time, I needed something.
Yeah.
But no, actually, that's a lie. I was going to say I don't read a lot about Asian culture, but that's a complete lie, especially because I just came off reading a bunch of Cambodian
books. That was some nonfiction.
Books, yeah. About the troubles in Cambodia.
Yeah, Reese and I were lucky enough to go to Vietnam and Cambodia last year, and you had read some nonfiction stuff about the rise of the Khmer and you know, the communists taking control in Cambodia there.
And then on top of that, another book that I tend to recommend to everybody is Crazy Rich Asians.
Oh, yeah.
Not the movie, people. The book.
The book.
Because also, I don't know very much about Asian culture. So when I read something that's like, oh, Risa, yes, this is something that happens, or this is how people live in that part of the world, or how they interact with one another, then I'm intrigued. So yeah. I think you were like, this is Korean. You haven't read anything Korean. So I was like, oh, okay, cool.
I mean, that was one of the things I learned in grad school that, you know, you don't think about, but it is true. People, you like to learn when you're reading fiction, not in the dry scientific way, but I love reading about other cultures or learning things about stuff that, you know, I didn't know before. I absolutely love that. So on that note, though, this is, you know, Min Jin Lee lived in Japan for a little while. And as we get into the first 50 pages, we'll talk a little bit more about this. But I think this is one of the first things that I've encountered that was a well-selling book that was about Korea in the early 1900s. It was about Japanese occupied Korea. Again, you like
which,
to learn
again,
something.
Which, again, I know nothing about. Yeah. Nothing about. I always say this to Andy, but when I was in high school, or like, you know, when you're in your history classes in high school, I don't remember getting much past, like, I don't even think I made it to the Vietnam War in general. So I always have lots of questions about these things because I'm sure I'd like touched on it in school, but I don't think I actually really like took a course in anything post, you know,
post-Vietnam,
1952.
Shout out to that New York State curriculum.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember going past the Vietnam War into the early 80s, but it was much more rushed there. I remember spending a lot of time on reasons people wanted to abandon gold and get into silver in the late 1800s.
Oh my gosh, I know nothing about that.
That was, I love history. I double majored in history in school, but that was about the most boring thing I remember from my history classes in 11th grade. It was like, wow, thrilling.
Yeah.
Let's get off gold and onto silver. But let's get off of this tangent about American history and let's get into these first 50 pages of Pachinko. So, okay, I'm going to pick on you here like I pick on everybody else.
Please.
Do you remember the quote at the beginning of the book before the book even starts?
You know, you say that because you know I'm not going to remember it, which is fine. I'm.
Do you notice quotes before the start? Or you just go right into the...
I usually don't have the patience to notice those quotes. And then I'll get like partially through the book and I'll be like, maybe I should look at that.
Yeah.
But the most part, I ignore them.
Yeah.
Which is horrible. We should respect other people. and their quotes, and I'm sure there's very good reasons for them to be there. But
well, the quote in the beginning of this book is a Charles Dickens quote, and I just think that's funny because this book seems to me to be a very well-told story, and that's what I associate with Charles Dickens, but also sort of a lengthy, like a long
story. Yeah, and actually now that I'm thinking about this, I mean, as the book progresses, it is, the format of it is very much like each chapter, something really significant happens, but it's chapter by chapter, which I imagine most of Charles Dickens's literature came out as, because it was these big chapters in newspaper articles, right?
Yes, they were newspaper / literary magazines. Yeah. Yeah, that's how he sort of had these little pieces that came out and added up to a big thing.
Maybe that was a inspirational nod.
Yep. The first line of the book is, "History has failed us, but no matter," which I think is a great opening line. Great. It begins in Yeongdo, Busan, Korea, which is a tiny like island fishing village. So the book starts, and the characters that we get at the very beginning are the fisherman and his wife, which I think is very fairy tale esque.
It reminds me of that fairy tale with the fisherman and his wife.
Is that the one where the fish talks to the fisherman?
I think it's his wife wants something, and the fish talks to him and says, "Oh yes, I will give you that for your wife."
Yeah. So they, like the fisherman and his wife, they never really have a name. They have three sons. The only one that survives is one named Huni. Huni is born with a cleft palate and a twisted foot. And this comes up a lot, at least in these first 50 pages, this idea of children being born, a few of them not surviving, the only one that does survive. We see this sort of repeated, physical attributes to them are sort of going through this family's timeline. The novel goes through, again, like I said earlier, it touches on Japan's annexation of Korea and, you know, in this early 1900s. But we get back into Huni's story. Huni learns to read and write in Japanese because this is one of those places and times where the upper class would speak Japanese because they were Japanese, and the lower classes would speak Korean. But you couldn't really get by without speaking Japanese. So Huni learns to read and write. He ends up helping his parents run this house that they own. And after he turns 28, which is fairly old at that point in time to get married, a matchmaker comes and convinces his mom to approve a marriage with Yang Jin, who is very young. She's only 15. She's the youngest of four, and she's kind of poor. She lives on the other side of the island, but it's an arranged marriage, and they get married. So that is something that I feel... Was there an arranged marriage in the Elena Ferrante novels?
No, there actually wasn't.
No, interesting.
You say that because in my family, there, on my mom's side, there are some arranged marriages. And so I find that incredibly interesting from so many different standpoints, because I know my grandmother was like completely fine with her arranged marriage.
Yeah.
Like she was never, I think she was like 20 when she got married, mm-hmm. And when I spoke to her about it, it was very many years later. Her thought on it when I remember speaking to her about it was that she had to learn to love my grandfather. Like it was a requirement because not a requirement. It was, they had to learn to do that. They had to grow together.
Right.
It wasn't about, you know, divorcing or, you know, that wasn't an option.
That was the option
they had to figure out how to do it, which is a very interesting way to look at relationships. I mean, I think it's an incredible lesson. You know, it's, you didn't leave your crap in the middle of the floor, and so I'm going to leave you. Yeah. It's, you know what I mean? You have to get past those things.
Yeah, which is very much the way these two characters in Pachinko sort of look at it.
Right.
Huni, with his cleft palate and his twisted foot, knows that he's not, you know, the most desirable match.
But see,
for
at the same time, what's interesting too is he is a desirable match other than his
club because palette. He can read and write, because he runs this house and has some business savvy,
he comes from a decent family. Like,
no, they're poor fisher people.
But I mean, like, good stock is the best way to say it.
Yeah, yeah, it's not like they don't have any money, but he is savvy on the street. And but then on the other side of that, Yang Jin is the youngest of four. and they kind of have to marry her off. Her family has to marry her off because they don't really have enough food for everybody. It really is hard times for them. And so, again, for them, there's no, like, well, if it doesn't work out, we can always split up. They have to learn to love each other and learn to build a life together. So your family, by the way, is Calabria, Italy. Yes, they came from Calabria. I just think that's worth mentioning.
Not Busan.
Not Busan, Korea. So the first time that they meet is on their wedding day. And I have this quote written down that I like. They were married so quietly that if the family had not sent out mugwort cakes to the neighbors, they would have been accused of stinginess. Yes, and the mugwort cakes are apparently that's like a wedding tradition in Korea, is to make mugwort cakes and sort of announce that. But it is a quiet marriage. And again, I think that there is sort of a small amount of embarrassment on both sides, but they make this relationship work and they absolutely love each other. Much like Hoonie's siblings, though, Yangjin, their firstborn child, has a cleft palate. The child passes away. And a second child passes away, and a third child passes away. And actually, as we're going through this again, Hoonie was the third. There are these numbers. There are these threes, which again feels very fairy tale-esque. These, like, after the first, after the second, after the third. There's a lot of numbers in here, and I think that it ties into the game Pachinko later, I'm sure, but...
I mean,
when I think of pachinko, I think of numbers. So there's always that's what I'm trying to say. So finally, they do have a daughter. Her name is Sunja, and there's some sort of skipping around here and there. When Sunja is 13, Hoonie dies from tuberculosis, and chapter one ends with Yangjin and Sunja going back to work. And so they run this house now, which is sort of an inn / boarding house for workers. There's a rotating cast. There are some fishermen that go out during the day and come back at night and sleep. And then there are these other guys that work all night and then sleep during the day. So they just sort of rotate them back and forth.
Which is a cool thing that, again, I didn't know very much about these boarding houses, and also about sleeping situations. And just I found interesting in this talking about setting up the places for them to sleep at night.
Yeah, they sort of share
bedrolls.
Yeah, and they kind of share the space and the bed itself. Like, imagine when you get up to go to work, wherever you work. Thank you for that contribution, Noodle. Imagine getting up to go to work, and as you're at work, someone is sleeping in your bed all day. And that's sort of the situation that they have. But they also, I mean, it's nice. These characters they're strong women running this boarding house too. So she definitely sets you up from the beginning of with these strong characters.
And it's also, this book definitely goes through female characters. And like, you look at the cover and it's blue and it has a woman who's
dressed as a picture.
Coastline.
Yeah.
And then at the bottom is a woman with two other children.
Yes.
But it kind of, again, back to that multi-generational thing, you know, it's going to be about women passing through other women generationally.
Yeah.
It's kind of neat.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I know when I first started reading this, I could tell that this was Yangjin on the cover.
Yeah.
And so then I was dying to know who the other ones were.
We're about halfway through these first 50 pages. What character did you like most up to this point?
Oh, Hoonie.
Hoonie. No, right? I mean, Hoonie is such a lovely character. And she goes through these characters very quickly. Like I just said, we're about halfway through these first 50 pages and he's dead. He's gone. But he was a lovely character. So I think she does a really great job of establishing characters that you like very quickly. Mm-hmm. And there, a lot of them are people who put their head down and work hard, and they can't always make things right. But I remember a scene where Yangjin, when she's young and they have that first baby die, Hoonie just is very simple and sweet. He brings her warm rice cakes and just sort of says, you need to keep your strength up. And like, you can tell he very much cares about her. And again, in this relationship of
work. Other thing too is Yangjin speaks about him as though no other man would do this, that he is this cleft palate, twisted foot, not what she dreamed a man would be like for her, but yet he is the most lovely husband that could possibly be.
Yeah. So she does a great job.
Also,
that,
it's very sweet. I love a father-daughter relationship with his daughter.
Him and Sunja. Sunja, like, she loves him.
Sunja's the daughter, and
yes,
mom is
Yangjin.
I think I mixed it up a minute ago. But you know what I'm talking about.
Right, but Sun Jia absolutely idealizes him. Mm-hmm. Then we get this weird thing. Well, I have a quote written down, which I remember thinking to myself, this is the crux of this book, which is men have choices, women don't. And I think that is sort of the theme of this book. I just thought that was a good one to point out. So then we get this weird little interjection with a man named Beck Isaac, which the name stands out as being very different. And you come to learn that he's looking for this boarding house because he's looking for Huni specifically. And his brother had had a relationship with Huni and sort of given him the name of this place if he needs to come stay. And you learn that he is a Catholic priest looking for a place to stay. And that's why his name is a little different. Turns out that Beck Isaac is walking through the rain and he goes to the house to stay and he might have tuberculosis, which puts the whole house in jeopardy.
Well, it's also he gets there and he's like, oh, my brother, he stayed here and he told me to stay here. And they're not, she's not going to let him in just because they don't have the space. And then she's like, you know what? No, you should stay. And then
Young Jin's kindness wins out in the end. But through all of this, the most interesting thing to me is that we get a very brief mention that Young Jin is not speaking with her daughter Sun Jia because Sun Jia is pregnant and the father is not going to raise the baby. And that's just sort of sprinkled into all of this. And when you were first reading this, did you catch that? Did you think, wait, what?
Well, so that's the interesting thing in these chapters and just the way that she writes. Mm-hmm. And I think what kept me reading those first 50 pages mm-hmm. is that these big things happen in each chapter. And it's literally these, I remember the sentence, oh, now I want to find it.
Yeah.
For the past week, they had been speaking only when necessary. The servant girls couldn't figure out what happened to make Sunja so quiet. But on 22, they say, none of this mattered anymore since recently Sunja had lost all of her prospects. She was pregnant and the baby's father was unable to marry her. A week ago, Sunja had confessed this to her mother, but of course, no one else knew.
And then what's the next sentence?
The next sentence is, Ajumoni, Ajumoni. The older servant girl shrieked at the front of the house where the lodger slept, and Young Jin rushed to the room. Sunja dropped her rag to follow her. So immediately something else happens. Right. It's like we've dropped this giant bomb.
Yep.
And then
in the middle of the action of them finding out that this boarder has tuberculosis, which is high stakes in general.
So
does that keep you reading? Did you like that? Did you feel like, yes, that makes you want to?
Yeah. But again, nothing is dragged out. Like everything is just so abrupt.
Yeah.
Which is kind of fun and keeping not fun. Tuberculosis is not fun.
The way she writes, though, is very... I mean, I don't want to say it's economical because it's not like she's short with her words.
Economical is kind of a good way to say it,
though. But there's no wasted... You're not... There's no part of the book, or at least these first 50 pages, where you're reading and thinking, why are you telling me this?
Which is very funny because this book...
Yeah, it's very long.
...is very long. I'm going to tell you how long it is. It is 484 pages.
Yeah, 484 pages, and yet you think... You know that all of the information she's giving you is pertinent to the story.
Yeah.
But I think that, I mean, and we've seen this with different writers on the podcast. I keep pointing this out because it is such a great part of writing and a good trick to sort of tell your audience what's happening or something that's going on or just something bad. Like, she's not saving that secret to be a big reveal, a big cliffhanger. She just tells you, Sun Jia's pregnant, the father's not around. Anyway, let's get back to this. And you think, wow, wait, what? I want to know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
We see it. It's the way that Little Fires Everywhere starts, where you sort of see something and then we go back to it. Nickel Boys, he says, on the day that Elwood was arrested. And you're like, wait, what? Elwood was arrested? It is a very common thing that you see. And I think it's great. I think it keeps people reading. It's a nice way to drop information and keep you engaged in what's going on. So the end of these pages, chapter 3, is sort of where you get to the last bit. And this is all Sun Jia. This is Sun Jia's story here. Sun Jia goes to the market to get things for her mother. And there she meets this very handsome man named Han Su, who seems very sophisticated and very worldly, and they start this secret relationship where she will bring laundry to the beach at the edge of the island, and Han Su will come, and there they will supposed to fold laundry, but they just talk and share and start to fall in love.
Yeah, but it starts in a really, really even weirder way.
Yeah.
In that, you know, he protects her from
So she's at the market. Yeah, she's at the market and she's shopping, and these Japanese teenagers come by and they start teasing her, and they're teasing her in Japanese and she can't really speak Japanese. And it goes
nor
very
understand it.
Right. It goes kind of far. It goes from just them teasing her to really her feeling threatened that they're going to rape her, and Hansu steps in and is like, you know, get out of here. And again, we see this class thing very much where these teenagers don't care. They are the high citizens, right? They can do anything they want and it doesn't matter. Right. And Hansu is a Korean man stepping in. At first they say like, who are you? And then we kind of learn that he is a very wealthy man and he has a lot of clout in society. So for Sunja, she's sort of intrigued as to why he's so interested in her.
Yeah, but what struck me was as they talk more, he tells her to call him something.
Like, he tells her to call him
older brother.
Yes.
If I remember correctly. And now I want to remember how to say older brother.
Yeah. He asks her to think of him sort of like an older brother. Think of him as somebody who will protect her. And it's weird. At this point, she's 17 and he's 34. And she absolutely falls in love with him. And again, so we know at this point in time, she will get pregnant and the father won't be around. So what seems like a very nice relationship, if not a bit weird because he's so much older than her.
And secret.
And secret, right, starts to, you already see the edges of it kind of blurred and fraying. So at some point in time, they gather the laundry together and just have nice conversations. It's a different day where they go to gather mushrooms together that they end up having sex in the middle of the woods. And that's where she's, you know, completely head over heels in love with him. She is waiting for him.
I think that it's also kind of important to point out that it's clear that he loves her too.
Yes.
It's not really like it's not so much a...
It's not a one-sided
relationship. She's getting more out of it than he is. Like, they clearly are falling for each other.
Yes, yes. So he goes away to Japan on business, and while he's away, she discovers that she's pregnant, and she thinks, this will be great. I will have a baby, and we can have a house, and she very much falls into these daydreams of having a life with Hansu. But when he comes back, she discovers that while he was away, he was visiting his wife and his children, and he's basically has her as a mistress. And when he finds out she's pregnant, he's delighted, but he basically says to her, I'll buy you a house and you can raise the baby. He wants two families.
His mentality is that, oh yes, I have a family in Japan and you will be my family here.
Yes.
And that's a lovely, lovely thing. And she, again, what I think is the first of lots of righteous female moments in the book, where she is like, but that doesn't work for me. And actually it's really lovely in the book the way that she kind of discovers that. And she's like, but I should be happy to be that.
Yeah.
Like, you would provide for me.
Right.
And like, he doesn't make her feel like she's going to be left for wanting or wouldn't come and be with her or anything along those lines. He actually makes her feel like his marriage in Japan would almost be secondary to this one.
Right.
Because that was much more of a business agreement.
Yeah.
And that this is his relationship for love. And she's like, she basically is like, no.
Yeah.
That's...
At reading this, was there sort of a part of you that was torn thinking to yourself, you should take that because you'd be happy? Like, clearly you love this man. He's offering you a home and security and you can raise your child knowing, you know, that the child would be all right and not wanting for anything. It was there a part of you that was thinking that wouldn't be so bad, and not like 100% like, yeah, take it, but something sort of torn? Or is that a gender thing? Is that me thinking for her, oh, maybe that was all right, but then when she speaks up and says, no, I don't want that, you think to yourself, yeah? Or when he offered that to her, were you like, no, scumbag, don't, you're a jerk?
I think that he was a scumbag, but I think, and maybe this is therapist Risa showing, but I think that it's a very mature thing to realize that a person cannot be happy with their life until they can respect themselves or love themselves and feel that they make smart and wise decisions. And it's like she knows that if she makes this decision, while it is fiscally more responsible and she would be happy. She wouldn't be happy because it would be putting herself down mm-hmm. and below him. It wouldn't, you know, she'd always have to just succumb to what he, where he's going. Like, mm-hmm. is he going back to Japan and whatnot?
Right.
So it's a very mature decision on her part where she kind of basically is like, no, yeah.
Well, and to look at the historical context.
And this happens like so quickly.
Yeah, again, it's the last couple pages before page 50.
Well, yes. I mean, yeah, but also the decision that she makes, because again, she goes to the beach telling yes. him, and they're all so excited for a minute, and then it's like all of a sudden she's like, no.
Yeah.
No, I won't yeah. do that.
And I get to put this in historical context as well. Saying no to this would be her being a single woman with a baby and in a world where she is a second-class citizen in her own country with the Japanese running things. And so not only would she be a single woman, but a single Korean woman in a world run by Japanese people. To make that decision is very brave and very, I mean, she clearly knows what, I mean, it is a very mature decision. You're right.
Mm-hmm. Well, she even says, so the decision is just very abrupt. And she said there was a baby inside her belly and this child would not have a real father like the one she'd had.
Yep.
So it's a decision based on the fact that she loved her father and he mm-hmm. was so good to her, and she could not bear to have a child not have the kind of father that she had. And yep. then immediately she says, I will never see you again.
Yeah. Which shocks Hansu.
Right. So it again, everything so quickly, and then, you know, the next page is basically the end of the chapter.
Yeah. I made it to page 51 because the chapter ends on page 51. It is like two or three paragraphs. So technically I read to page 51. But there was a lot in those first 50 pages. A lot of, I mean, it almost to me feels like a sort of microcosm of what I expect this book to be. A lot of family stuff, a lot of fast moving family things happening. But we hit the end of these first 50 pages. How are you feeling about it?
I was really into it. I was like, I gotta keep reading. And when we read this initially for our practice version, I think I told you, I was like, I won't be able to stop reading if I'm into it. So you need to read it first. And then I think you did. And then mm-hmm. I was like, I don't remember.
We were going to Scotland to visit our friends out there. Shout out to Audrey and Tom. We were going out to Scotland and Risa said, you read this first because once I start reading it, I won't want to give it back to you to read. So I read through the first 50 pages on the plane ride over and then gave it to Risa, and you kept reading from there. So,
and I find it funny too because I don't think this is a book that you would normally pick up.
Right. But so you would delve in after these first 50 pages.
Yeah. Yeah. I did delve.
You delved to the end.
I did.
Yes.
400 and however many pages later. Yeah.
And now why do you say this isn't something that I would usually pick up? You know me better than anybody. So why, when you looked at this, why do you think, well, this isn't something Andy would like?
So I feel like you usually read things that like are more tongue-in-cheek, and this is not tongue-in-cheek. Like there's nothing funny about it.
Hmm.
And not that it's not charming. It's
yeah,
charming in the way that it's written and also the relationships that are in it. But yeah, I wouldn't think that you would come home with this book.
Yeah.
By any way, shape, or form. So when you were reading it and you were like, oh, wow, this is really well written. And
yeah.
That was kind of fun.
Yeah. You know, we get to the end of these first 50 pages. And like I said, it moves fast. But Minjin Lee really does make you like all of these characters and really root for them. And so I got to the end of these first 50 pages and it was definitely a delve in for me. Now I haven't finished it in the time since then. And honestly, when I compare it to some other books on the shelf, it's one that like I look at and I'm like, I know I need to finish that because I did think that it was so well written and so well constructed. And I really liked learning things about Korea and about Korea at that time. And rooting for these characters was great. They have optioned this for an Apple TV series.
Really?
Yes. But they apparently did that last year in 2018. So where is the series? If this is turned into a TV series, would you watch it?
I would. I would never be a head-to-head guest for you. Because I'm one of those people that is like, oh, there's a book. I will read the book and I will almost never want to see the movie afterward, or I'll hate the movie. Mm-hmm. Like Harry Potter, love the books, hate the movies. Mm. They're fine. But I sit there the whole time being like, no, this is not right. Let me be curmudgeon-y. No, I have no interest in continuing.
But what about this one would make you want to watch the TV show?
Again, because it's this Eastern culture that I don't know very much about. Mm-hmm. So to actually see the visuals of these places like Busan, mm-hmm. and understand what that looks like would be really cool. Because again, I can picture things in my head, but to be able to see it would be very different. And also, you know, I look at Crazy Rich Asians and I was really excited for that movie. Again, not because I loved the book. And so I was like, not super excited to see the movie, but because there are so few movies and depictions in cinema of Asians and like full Asian movies, like of full Asian casts. Mm-hmm. And
in Western cinema.
Right. Yeah. Correct.
Yeah.
So I was excited to see that. And so I feel like I would feel the same way if they turned this into some sort of miniseries.
Yeah. After finishing this book and after wanting to delve in after the first 50 pages, who would you give this book to read?
So I did give it to people to read.
Yes.
And in fact, my copy is with a nurse right now. I told basically anybody that I told to read My Brilliant Friend, I told to read this just because, again, I felt like it was... And in some ways, I feel like this is a better coming-of-age story than My Brilliant Friend.
Ooh, shots but fired.
It's mostly because my feelings on My Brilliant Friend... Okay, I'm a pediatric music therapist. I hang out with children all day long. I have to worry about their inner workings and how they feel and all this other crap. And so I'm not terribly interested in hearing about what children think. That sounds awful. I really do
but you're
care.
You're saying you don't want to read
I don't want to read.
And learn what children think?
Well, like, if you've read My Brilliant Friend, you know that there's, like, this whole portion about her doll and her friend's doll. And I just remember reading it and being like, I really don't care. I just don't care about your doll.
She turned that into
I know
a,
you love your doll.
She turned that into a children's book, by the way.
And she did.
There was this controversy with
I had
that
no idea.
Because in this book meant for children, there was the word shit.
Oh, and yeah, I remember you saying
this. There was this big controversy with that. And, you know, the argument was, well, in Italy, it would be merda, right? Or is that the Spanish?
Merda.
Yeah, merde, right?
Merda. Yeah.
That is sort of more along the lines of, like, poop, or it's, like, not as much of a curse. And that Italian children are more used to hearing that, and it was
and
sort of a translation
being called
thing.
Merda Celu, which means little shit.
Little shit, which Risa was called as yeah. a child. So I know that was funny. But so you feel like this is, you felt like Pachinko was a better coming of age story. So you would recommend
yeah.
it to people looking for a coming of age. I mean, you were giving it to other people who were big readers at
right.
the hospital where you work, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, as far as a coming age story, a good way to see how people find their own way.
Yeah.
But again, comparing it to My Brilliant Friend, it was basically as far as coming to of age part. My Brilliant Friend is all that part up until she's 15. Hmm. This is like 15 over.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I skipped all that other stuff
yeah.
where I was like, yeah, cool. I don't need that.
Yeah. I mean, I would give this actually to fellow grad students or you know, alumni of the program. I think this is a great book for writers to read because I think she writes it so well. But I also think that it is really good literary fiction. And I think that I met a lot of people at NYU who were lovers of good literary fiction. So I think that this one, it's a little bit older at this point in time, but if you haven't read it yet and you like it, then I think this is definitely one to check out. If you had to blind date with a book, this book, and give it some comparative titles other than My Brilliant Friend, what's another book or couple books that you would compare this one to?
Again, I would say Pillars of the Earth.
Pillars of the Earth.
It's also an interesting telling from a mother's perspective, because it very much is, it goes on to be very much about being a mother and what that means, and making decisions for your family, and also as a woman making decisions for the family, which is really interesting, because the women in this book definitely become the matriarchs, which I'm not an expert, but according to the book, it's not done in that part of the world in
head of the family and being a matriarch, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And as a person that very much comes from a family of matriarchs, I find it terribly interesting. So I'm trying to think of other matriarchal type of books.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. I'll throw out a bit weirder of a comp book, but one more in my wheelhouse, which is Norwegian Wood by Haruki Murakami. Only for the way that it's written in a very, like, very lovely way. And I think that Murakami also is, you know, very economical with his writing. But that one is a coming-of-age story as well. It's about a college, you know, a guy who starts college after his best friend in high school committed suicide. It's basically just him growing up in college and sort of dealing with the death of his friend and sort of his friend's girlfriend and their relationship kind of evolving and being and flowing. So in that way, I think that it's like very well, very lush written. So that's definitely a delve in for me and definitely a delve in for Risa. And in fact, you finished it and you finished it fairly quickly too. So
yeah, it actually, again, I think because of the format again where major things happen in every chapter, like major things, it's not just like, oh, she lost her shoe. No, it's like
she lost her doll, like that one,
lost her doll down.
well
so it made it a really easy read, and I think the nurse that has it right now, I think that she's she has, and Leah, if you're listening, I think that she's just, it's such a tomb, like a tome, if you will. So I think it's a scary book
You think she hasn't finished it yet?
Well, I think that she hasn't picked it up because she's so afraid of how big it is. Right.
Did you feel like it was a fast read, though, despite that?
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah.
It definitely was. Why is this page all funky? Then it makes me wonder, why is it funky? No, there's no reason why it's funky.
No. It's just the copy I took from the store on a wiki page. So.
But yeah, I think that it is deceiving in that you pick it up and you're like, holy shit, this is going to take me way too long.
Yeah.
And I think once you get started, it moves really, really fast.
Yeah.
Which is great. I love the chapters, the ones where it's important. You know, they say exactly where it's taking place and the year.
Yes.
And I loved being able to go through and be like, this is in 1939. This is in 1962.
Yeah, that's something I think that Jess and I touched on in our pet episode, and that I touched on, I think, a little bit in Little Fires Everywhere. I think I really like when books tell me that, when and where exactly it is. I feel like it just lets me jump right into knowing things a little bit better. So sometimes when it doesn't happen, I'm like, well, where am I? I just don't know, and I'm confused. So I'm glad that you also like that, and it's not just me.
But so. I hate that in television shows, like when they jump 5 years ahead.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what the fuck? Where did those 5 years go?
They weren't important. Well, there's another special reason to do Pachinko, and that is that Minjin Lee, much like Risa and I, has a November birthday. So happy birthday, Minjin Lee. Her birthday was November 11th. Smack dab in the middle.
Oh, she's Veterans Day.
Yep, smack dab in the middle of me and Risa. And she shares a birthday with my very favorite, Kurt Vonnegut, who also was November 11th. So happy November birthdays to anybody out there who, like Risa and I, shares a November birthday.
Scorpio season.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Risa, for going all the way from the living room to the bedroom to record this with me. Is there anything you want to add or shout out while you're here?
Noodle. He's really great.
Shout out Noodle.
I shouted out Noodle before.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say, read. Please read.
Read.
And also listen to music. And also, self-care is important. Mm. And so take care of yourself during this time of year. Because I find that while I love November, it's a hard time of year, so, you know, take care of yourself. And that's easier said than done, I'm the first to admit. But read a book.
Yeah.
Listen to the music that you like. Pet your doodle.
Pet your dog.
Or cat.
Or gerbil.
Or parakeet.
Or fish. Pet your fish.
I don't think the fish would like it.
So pachinko is definitely a delve for me. Definitely a delve for Risa. And if it's one,
let's see if you delve. Let's see if you actually delve.
The challenge has been posed. If it's something you haven't read and you're sort of looking at it and find it daunting, take Risa's advice. It's a faster read and it's less daunting than you think it's going to be. So
what is 400 pages? It's just a whole bunch of scrolling on Facebook. So
read it here instead.
read it instead. It's so much better because I really don't give a crap about what that person did yesterday.
Oh, going whoa, to the gym. Whoa. Now you're just alienating all of your Facebook friends.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Well, it's a delve for me and Risa. Thank you so much for being on, Risa. Good night from me. Good night from Risa. Good night from Noodle. He is quite literally asleep at the end of the bed right now. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Furthermore. Risa Rest, why don't you say, leave us off. Give us a good night.
Good night.
Oh, thank you, Risa. Thanks, everyone. Furthermore was created by Andy Dorado. It's written, edited, produced, and all music you hear is by Andy Dorado. If you've listened to the show before, then you know what I'm going to ask you next. You know what it is. You know what I'm going to ask you. Do you follow us on social media? If you don't, you should. It's so easy. We're on Instagram, Furthermore Podcast, all one word. We post lots of fun stuff there. Come check us out. It's where you can talk. It's where you can hang out and where you can get updates on when new Furthermore episodes are coming out. Listen, it was my birthday earlier this month, the 7th of November, and yeah, it was my 30th birthday this year. And the only thing I want from my birthday is for you to tell a friend about Furthermore. No, wait, world peace. You know what? Screw it. Yeah, let's just tell a friend about Furthermore. It's the best way for podcasts to grow. And if you have a friend that likes reading, that likes books, or is just looking for a new podcast to entertain them, please tell them about Furthermore. All the artwork for Furthermore is done by Max Farinato, who you can find on Instagram at cbartist_ or online at maxfarinto.com. Thank you to Max for all the great work you do for Furthermore. And if you ever need any artwork done, please, I beg you to go to Max. I loved what he did for Furthermore. If you're starting a podcast and you want a cool Raven logo, that's what I did. So please check Max out. I guess I had to dig deep back into my book of books that I read this year for the book that I loved in April, and I found it. It was Orange World by Karen Russell. Now, this book of short stories actually didn't come out till May this year, but I'd gotten the arc of it, and I absolutely loved it. Listen, I have so many collections of short stories sitting on the floor by my bed. We get advanced reader copies of them at the store. I always think I need them. I take them home, and then I just don't love reading them as much as I love reading a novel. But Karen Russell makes me forget that I don't love short stories. My favorite short story of all time is called The Barn at the End of Our Term from her collection Vampires in the Lemon Grove, which is about Rutherford B. Hayes reincarnated as a horse with a bunch of other presidents reincarnated as horses in some sort of purgatory heaven stables, and he's obsessed with the fact that his wife had been reincarnated as a sheep. It's just as weird as it sounds, and it's so up my alley. I love Karen Russell's short stories. The highlight of Orange World for me was Bog Girl, which is about a boy in Scotland who pulls a dead mummified bog body, much preserved and much mummified, and he ends up taking her to prom and falling in love, and everybody at prom is jealous of how beautiful she is. It's just weird, and it's fantastic. I really want to thank Risa for coming on this episode of Furthermore to talk pachinko with me, and also for all of the love and support she gives to Furthermore. It really wouldn't be possible without her. She does a lot of social media stuff behind the scenes. She gives me great feedback on every single episode I record, and I want to thank her for volunteering to record that initial practice episode. If you have a significant other or you're married, you know it's not always easy to create something with your partner, but we had a blast doing this. I think it came out great. So thank you to Risa for all the love and support you give me and to the podcast. Hey, from everybody here at Furthermore, from me, from Risa, from Noodle, we want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving. If Furthermore has somehow found its way into your life and is a podcast that you love, I am so thankful that you found it. I'm so thankful that you listen. You really have made this experience so much fun for me. If you are traveling this holiday season, stay safe. And if you need a book recommendation for those long flights on a plane or just need to get away from your family for a little bit, please reach out to me. It's what I do. I know this time of year can be hard for some people, so reach out to your friends and family. Make sure they're doing okay, and just know that we at Furthermore are so thankful for you. I hope everyone out there eats a ton of stuffing, a ton of turkey. The dark meat is the best part, don't forget that, and gets a chance to just relax and enjoy this holiday season. I'm Andy Dorado, and hey, keep reading.
If we were an accident, I'll swear you to the stars. A regression's just a point on a line we call a scar. I made a vow to carry the